Dolores, darling, I love you so. Why did you leave me? Why did you go? I've always loved you, Dolores. Come back to me. Dolores, darling, you are my all. Please come back. Won't you please hear my call? I love you dearly, Dolores. Come back to me.
So when I was filling in last night for Rick Kogan, Mr. Brown called and said, do you remember the four buddies, Dolores? And he said, they used to be on Savoy. I said, oh, I remember the four buddies. They were actually the five buddies, and those are the wrong four buddies. All right, so to quickly clear this up, in case you were into vocal group harmony and think the four buddies Dolores is a terrific record, it was on Club 51 in 1956, and it didn't chart. There were four buddies on Savoy in 1951. They were from Baltimore. Larry Harrison, Gregory Carroll, Burt Palmer, Tommy Smith. All right, they had one hit, a big hit, too. I Will Wait was number two in 1951 on Savoy. Our guys are Chicagoans all the way. They started out at the housing project, Ida, oh, whatever. Anyway, I can't think of the name right now. In any event, they were hanging around Club 51, which was part of the Savoy record mart that Jimmy Davis owns. And about 1954, McKee Fitzhugh had them on the radio, and they wound up getting signed to Jimmy Davis's label, also Club 51. And bottom line was, when they're putting out the record, they said, you know, let's call them the Four Buddies, because there was a more popular Four Buddies that used to be on Savoy. So our Four Buddies were really the Five Buddies when it came time for the record, and were in no relationship whatsoever. And I should probably give a shout out to all who they were, if I can remember. Allersey Manor, Jimmy Hawkins, Willie Bryant, Dickie Umbra, and Irving Hunter joined. Sam Hawkins had left, so that's who they were. So anyway, that's the deal. They are the Four Buddies, except no, they're the Five Buddies, and they are from Chicago. I'm glad we had this little chat. I'm Raleigh James, in for G, who will be back next Monday promptly, I promise. Until then, I'll hold down the fort. And it is Memorial Day, and so we've talked about a variety of things tangentially related, and can't let it go by without talking about, and this is just a fascinating story, and that is shot down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-57, Susan Ruth. And the person to talk about it would, of course, be Steve Snyder. So, Steve, welcome to WGN Radio.
Well, thanks, Ben. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm delighted to talk to you, because I was unaware of the saga from the start. And when I first started reading, what I realized very quickly was that, this is a story of what happened on the ground after they were shot down. And this is more than just pilot Howard Snyder. So first question, is he any relation to you?
He's my dad, or was my dad.
So, of course, from the time that you could think, you were aware of World War II stories, to say the least. And you heard about this your whole life, but when you started to research it, how did it tie into the stories you'd heard?
Yes, growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force, and he flew bombing missions over Europe. And in February of 1944, his plane was shot down over Belgium, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture. And he eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail and learn more about it. My parents had kept a lot of material about the war years, and going through that was just absolutely fascinating. And 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so compelling and so unique. It needed to be told. People needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book.
Well, 25 book awards would be on your side on that. Obviously, it's compelling to a lot more than just your family, and that's 4.5 years of dedicated research. So like I say, you grew up with the stories, but now you're researching them in depth. What was the oddest or strangest or fact that really kind of made you say, whoa?
Well, there were several, but I'd have to say that the most unique thing and the exciting thing and the most surprising thing was finding the German Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane, Hans Berger.
Oh, my God.
And I interviewed him for the book. Fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war, so he speaks perfect English, and he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. And amazingly, the gunners on my dad's plane shot Hans Berger down at the same time that he shot my dad's plane down. So they shot each other down.
Wow, so they both wind up on the ground. But fortunately for Hans, he's on friendly territory, so they're not going to cart him away. Was he aware to any degree what happened to your dad and the others involved?
Oh, no. He said that after, he had to bail out of his plane, but he did see the parachutes from some of my dad's crew coming down as he was coming down. But as you mentioned, Belgium was occupied by Germany, the Nazis at that time, so they picked him up. He went back to his base and continued the fighting in the war. So, that's really all he knew. It was amazing because all my dad knew and all the U.S. military knew was that two German fighters, two Focke-Wulf 190s, attacked my dad's plane and shot him down. And that's all I thought I'd ever know until I fortunately found Hans.
So they weren't aware that they actually successfully shot down the other guy?
No, they weren't.
Wow. And, of course, if you're a World War II hero from America, it is, and rightfully so, an honor. If you're a World War II hero from the Nazis in Germany, not so much. Especially now, even in Germany, they'd like to erase their history, from what I can tell. How did the years treat Hans Berger?
Well, the only person still living from the shot down story is Hans Berger.
Wow.
All my dad's crew was gone. Actually, five of B-17 had a 10-man crew. Five of them died during the war, and the other five have passed away since then. And all the Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help my dad and other members of his crew were all gone. So Hans is the only one still with us. He's 96 years old, lives in Munich, Germany, and we've become friends. But he was shot down three times during the war and fortunately made it through the war. And after the war, he has quite a story. You could almost write a book about him as well. He was almost sent to Siberia by the Russians because the Russians, where the Soviet Union was occupying East Germany at the time. But after the war became, as I said, he became a translator and now is doing pretty well, even though he's 96 years old.
Well, it's interesting because, of course, as I say, coming out of the Nazi regime, it sort of marks you in a way. And with that in mind, obviously, soldiers for any country don't get to make the big decisions. I'm not claiming that he was in any way in charge of anything, but clearly he was aware of the history. How did he feel about being a part of that side of the war?
Well, it brings back a lot of bad memories for him. The Luftwaffe, a lot of people don't realize there were really two elements of the German military during World War II. One was the Wehrmacht, the normal, traditional military forces. But the other side was the SS. They call them the Waffen, SS, the armed SS. And it was the SS that committed really all the atrocities and were, for a lack of a better word, the really bad and horrible part of the German military. So there is definitely a distinction. A lot of people don't realize there was that distinction of, because the Wehrmacht, they were traditional military. They had honor. They respected their opponents.
Yeah.
And they had honor, but the SS did not. And they're the ones who controlled the concentration camps and committed, you know, the atrocities that we know about.
Yeah, that had to be a horrible conflict. You're not a part of it, but you're aware of it. And what do? You're caught in a very bad position. So good that he surmounted that and made a life worth living. But I want to talk about the people who had a lot more to deal with when they hit ground. Those on the B-17, Susan Ruth, and that's exactly where we're going to pick it up in a moment. If you've got any questions, by all means, you can join us. 312-981-7200. I'm Raleigh James, in for G on WGN Radio.
Oh, Dolores, I love you. Dolores, I love you.
I never knew before I met you. My life was so dark. You gave a little spark. Dolores, I love you. What more could I say? My heart
beats, yes.
When Mr. Brown first had mentioned Dolores yesterday, I said, oh, you mean the Mood Makers? And he said, no, but it reminded me that worth hearing nonetheless. Bambi, 1961. I think they're from New York. The label was around about a year. They had about six releases, and near as I could tell, no chart action on any of them. It was a New York group. But anyway, there it is, the Mood Makers. We are talking with Steve Snyder on WGN Radio, and his book, Shot Down, The True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the Crew of the B-17 Sarah Ruth, is available on Amazon at some great prices right now, so including as an Audible. So there are several ways to hear about it. Do you have any questions right now? You can call us 312-981-7200, but I'm otherwise going to monopolize Steve. So we talked about hands. Now let's talk about the crew on the Susan Ruth. How many people were on board?
Well, B-17 had a 10-man crew. There were four officers and six enlisted men. My dad was the pilot, first pilot, and as such he was the commander of the plane and the crew. And as such, he was able to name the plane, and the Susan Ruth was named after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas.
Oh, that's great. So was the nose cone painted with Susan Ruth on the side?
Well, it was painted in Illinois at Scott Field before they flew over to England. But then as soon as they got to England, they took that plane away from him because it was a brand new plane. They gave him a bunch of old beat up planes.
Oh.
And he didn't think they were good enough quality to put his daughter's name on there. And so it wasn't until he finally got a new plane he was going to paint it. But then he was shot down before he was able to paint it.
Oh, man. So here are 10 people shot down. How many people survived being shot down initially?
Well, two of the crew were killed in the plane when it was attacked by two German fighters, two Focke-Wulf 190s, and the other eight airmen were able to bail out. And then something different happened to each guy. And the book's not just about my dad, but it's about what happened to each member of the crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. As I mentioned, I think that five members of the crew came home, but five did not. So three other members of the crew were killed a couple months later on the ground.
By enemy forces, I assume.
Yes, 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 by the Nazis.
Yeah, that
tragic events.
Could not have been pretty. In the synopsis for your book, it says some evaded the Germans for a while, but were betrayed and then captured and shot, of course. But was the betrayal on the part of people they thought were trying to help them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Raleigh, and I have to apologize because I think I called you Ben earlier
show. That's okay.
And my grandson will be 4 years old in another couple of weeks. I just gotten a couple pictures of him, and so I had Ben on my mind, so I apologize for that.
No problem. So tell me about the betrayal.
Yes. Normally when the underground or resistance came across downed airmen after they bailed out, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. And so with my dad, something always went wrong, and they couldn't get him out. But some of my other members of my dad's crew, they hooked up with three members of my dad's crew hooked up with five members of other downed B-17s, actually from three B-17s, and they were hiding in a hut in the woods near Chimay, Belgium. And Belgium collaborator, told the Gestapo, the secret police of the Nazis, about them hiding there. And they came and surrounded the hut, arrested all eight men, plus two young Belgian men, took them into the schoolhouse in Chimay, interrogated them, brought them back out in the woods, and they shot all eight of the American airmen, and the two Belgian young men were sent to concentration camps, never to be heard from again. So, as far as my dad, he was helped by Belgian people, but that was very, pretty dicey because you never knew if these people could be collaborators and turn you over to the Germans. And there are several instances in the book when my dad was almost discovered by the Gestapo, but he fortunately evaded capture. Actually, he was hidden by Belgians for several months, and then he got tired of hiding, so he decided to join the French resistance.
Oh, God.
And which was an incredibly brave and courageous and kind of, some people would think, reckless thing to do. But then he sabotaged German convoys for a couple of months, until the U.S. armies came up through France after D-Day, and he was finally liberated.
Wow. Against all odds. Now, before he, I guess in some ways, as I say that, though, the French resistance might have been safer than taking a pot shot at which Belgian is on your side and which isn't. That you want to think that he's a great judge of character. There's also got to be a certain amount of luck in that. But over the years, did he ever explain what made him act on saying, yeah, this guy will protect me or this guy won't?
Well, he pretty much just had to trust him. It was a very stressful situation. After all, his plane was attacked by German fighters. It's on fire. He has to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his other buddies on the crew, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And as I said, he was being helped by complete strangers. They couldn't speak the same language to begin with. He had a little French Belgium dictionary, because right at the French Belgium in southern Belgium, they all spoke French that he could refer to. And as I said, he didn't know if any one of those could be a collaborator or not.
Right.
But he found some wonderful people, and he was moved around from place to place to place for several months. How long had he stayed at any place depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might stay at one house for one night, or he might stay at another house for 6 weeks.
How old was he at the time?
That's a good question. Well, he was 28 years old at the time, and at that time he was considered an old guy. They called him Pops or the old man, because most of the gunners on these B-17s were 18 or 19, and most officers were in their early 20s. So my dad was considered an old guy at that time.
That's what I thought, because you mentioned your older sister and things of this nature. Obviously, he was married. He had a family. Now, did he enlist in the war when World War II broke out?
Well, as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940, my dad went into the Army, enlisted in the spring of 1941. And actually, he was in the Army and in the infantry for a year before he went into the Air Force. He got married, and then my mother got pregnant, so he had a little baby on the way, and he didn't think he could support him very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, where he could make more money, especially particularly if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So he got into the Air Force just because of economic reasons.
Interesting. Now, when he did that, he was, obviously, he's aware World War II exists. We might not call it that, but the War of Europe. Did he have any inkling that he was going to be involved in it, that America was?
Oh, no. No one at the time did. I mean, the Japanese surprise attack December 7th, 1941, in Pearl Harbor just shocked and stunned the nation. They had did not see that coming at all. But all of a sudden, the U.S. was at war, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington at the time in the infantry. And, you know, all hands were on deck at that time. You know, all the young men started volunteering and enlisting.
Yeah.
And the war effort started.
And it was interesting because in some ways that's truly the last war we fought. At the end of World War II, the United Nations was formed, and now we have police actions, we have conflicts, we don't have quote-unquote wars. It was the last declared war, and I think it was also the last time that it was absolute and complete patriotism on the part of Americans. I don't know of any cases, maybe there were, of people who were protesting and condemning the war effort.
No, prior to Pearl Harbor being bombed, there was a big anti-war effort.
Right.
Charles Lindbergh was a leading figure in that, and that they did not want to get involved in another conflict like World War One in Europe, and they wanted to stay out. But once Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, then everyone was all in. And, not only all the guys who went into the military, but the entire nation rallied around the war, and there was rationing, and everyone collected any materials that they could provide to the war effort, tin, rubber, what have you.
Right. We were happy not to eat meat, and shrimp and rice is very nice and all those kind of things. But of course, with that, and I agree wholeheartedly from everything I've read, that it was very anti until Pearl Harbor. The conspiratorialists would say that that was a ruse to get Americans on board. Probably that's outside the extent of your research.
Well, yeah, that's a whole another topic and another subject, I think.
Yeah, no, I do too, but I didn't know what you ran across, because 4.5 years of research, oh my God. But in terms of surprises, not so much about the war, but any surprises about your dad in those research years?
Well, a couple things. One, as I mentioned earlier, his decision to get back in the fight and join the resistance, because he could have just stayed, being hidden by the Belgian people, hunkered down and just waited until the U.S. armies came up after D-Day. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th of 41, and he decided
We got to leave the Allies right there, because I'm against the news. It's a fabulous book. I hope people will read it. Thank you for joining us, Steve Snyder.